Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Aaron Smith. Aaron Smith is the author of two books of poetry published by the University of Pittsburgh Press, Appetite, a finalist for the Patterson Poetry Prize, the Lambda Literary Award, and the Publishing Triangle's Tom Gunn Award, and Blue on Blue Ground, winner of the Agnes Lynch Sterrett Prize. His work has appeared in numerous publications, including Court Green, Plowshares, Prairie Schooner, The Daily Beast, and Best American Poetry 2013. A 2007 fellow in poetry from the New York Foundation for the Arts, he's the poetry editor for Bloom and assistant professor of creative writing at Lesley University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Aaron. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we've had you before, but this time is special. You've come from Massachusetts, and I really appreciate you coming.
Thanks, and I have a new book out, and I'm happy and excited to share poems from it.
You do have a new book out, Appetite, and poems in Best American Poetry, and all kinds of good stuff is happening.
Very excited. Stay hungry, I guess, is what I've been joking with people for the title Appetite. It might be lame, but...
No, I think it works.
As soon as I sign that, stay hungry. So, yeah, for poems.
Okay. So you're going to start with poems from Appetite?
Yeah. I'll start with the one that was actually in Best American Poetry.
Okay.
What it feels like to be Aaron Smith. Though you would never admit it, you're still shocked by pubic hair and diesel ads on Broadway and Houston. And you wonder what conversations lead up to a guy posing with his pants unzipped to the forest. Maybe the stylist does it, but somebody had to think, let's show pubic hair. And was that person nervous about saying, hey, I have a great idea, pubic hair? You think about David Leddick's book, Naked Men 2, and the model with the cigarette whose mother photographed him with his jeans falling off and his pubic hair showing, and how that's weird, and you can't even begin to process how someone would let his own mother photograph him nearly naked and why a mother would want to. Everyone pretends pubic hair in pictures is artistic, but we all know it's really about sex, which you quickly remind yourself is okay too, because you're liberal, which you sometimes think means you don't believe in anything because you want people to like you. Then you think how you hate the phrase shock of pubic hair in novels and spend the next several minutes trying to think of a better phrase, shrub of, patch of, spread of, taste of, wad of. Then you think how Joyce Carol Oates describes fat men's chest as melting chicken fat in her story and get paranoid because you used to be fat and can never get your chest as tight as you want, no matter how much you bench press. You make a mental note to send poems to Ontario Review. Joyce Carol Oates is one of the editors and might like your work. They published Judith Vollmer's poem about the reporter covering a murder scene, and you love her and her poems. Maybe you should send her an email and see how she's doing. Then you think about pubic hair again, how embarrassing it can be at Dr. Ingalls when he examines you and stares at it. Do you have too much? How much can you trim and still look natural? Both of you trying to pretend it's professional when he asks you to move into the light, hold your penis like a pencil, squeezes your balls, this guy's fine, and you don't know how to be when he shakes your hand before you leave. Then you feel perverted because you're still thinking about pubic hair. Maybe everyone has pubic hair issues and nobody talks about it. You know for a fact Laura does because she told you after she read a Sharon Olds poem out loud and the two of you giggled. You think of Tara with thick eyeliner who said well-groomed underarms are really sexy, and you adopted that phrase when you say you think underarms are sexy. Well-groomed underarms, you say, and friends agree, especially Tom, who also loves underarms and sex clubs. You pass a hot guy, not as hot as the bag check guy at the Strand whose shirt comes up when he puts your backpack on the top shelf, and you want to sleep with him and stare, hoping he raises his arm so you can see his hair. You wonder if you have a disorder and then get mad as a taxi screams through your walk signal and think, I understand why people open fire on playgrounds. Then you feel bad because it's not about children. Even though they get on your nerves and nobody in Brooklyn disciplines their children, you pretend you didn't think that and think, I understand why people open fire in public places, like that's better. Then you get scared that maybe one day you'll snap and kill people, but probably not. Then you're really scared that everyone feels like this and we don't realize how great the potential for disaster is. Like yesterday, walking between a car and bus on Fifth, you trusted the bus driver to keep his foot on the brake and didn't worry he might pin you against the car and you'd end up like Christopher Reeve. Immediately, you try to decide if Christopher Reeve is a valid example of your fear or if you're just making fun of him. And you feel guilty. The way you feel guilty for laughing when Jeff says his messy apartment looks like Afghanistan. But you have to admit the metaphor of Superman becoming quadriplegic is pretty amazing. But you probably shouldn't. No, you shouldn't write that.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Aaron Smith, reading from his new book, Appetite. I really love that poem, but I love the obsessive rolling voice in that poem, and also how many times you say pubic hair in that poem. But can you talk about, you know, that, I mean, people obviously can't see it, but it's one hunk of poem, it's a prose poem. And can you talk about the construction of that poem? It's a page and a half, and I think it's has a lot of unexpected movement.
From a construction standpoint, the challenge for me was how to write a poem that long, you say a page and a half that's a block and keep it interesting. And, you know, when you take the line break out, you're immediately kind of moving yourself into a, I guess you call sort of a crisis state. You know, you can't rely on some of the techniques that you rely on as a poet. I know prose writers are like, you know, we write lots of pages without line breaks, but I wanted to keep the energy up in that poem. So I thought the repetition, and as comical as it is, I think coming back to the obsessive notion of a person thinking about pubic hair or whatever that strange thing is that people think about or obsess over was sort of a grounding presence in the poem. So it's comedic. It's something we don't often talk about, which I think is another reason that it works. And I'm hoping that it gives us a sense of just how quickly the mind can go and how quickly a person can think. And I really wanted to capture that sort of strange obsessiveness in a poem. I hope, suspect that other people often, you know, have their minds thinking and going all the time while we're our minds moving, while we're also moving our own body in the world. It also, I think, at the end becomes an Ars Poetica, which is a poem about a poem about poetry, and it's about what we will and won't say in poems. And I really wanted to think about those boundaries and how you shouldn't write that. There's so many shoulds placed on us as people and sometimes as writers, and I wanted to really think about getting in the face of all of those things that maybe I'm not supposed to do and seeing what would happen if I did them.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you definitely do them. And well, there's also such a great voice in that poem that seems so real. And I think your ability to get to the real in your poems, or sense of the real, not as in what happens, but how the voice sounds authentic, is really something. And I think it gives you the distinction of reaching people who don't know they love poetry. And I mean, I've heard people who have run into your work one way or another and love it, and it's often their entrance to poetry because they're like, I love this, but I don't like poetry. So how do they solve that? Can you address that at all?
Thanks. I really appreciate that. I've heard people say that. I don't usually read poems, but I really like these. And, you know, as a writer, I hope that it's, you know, I hope it's craft a lot too. You know, I hope that I'm succeeding in doing something that stands up from a craft element where I can look at it, put it under the microscope technically and think about it, but also something that's communicating. I'm very interested in the language that we use every day, that the language that we speak to one another in, and how we can wrench and use that and manipulate that into making it something worthwhile and interesting. I also think content's something that, you know, we sometimes don't talk about when we talk about poetry. We want to talk about craft all the time so people will know that we're smart, you know, that we're serious about our art, which is important. But I do think that the everyday topics are things that I'm interested in and other people are interested in reading. I love poetry that covers a whole range of themes and subjects, but there is something about reading something that feels like you're sitting down with a friend, you're sitting down with someone that's open, mm-hmm. that you can relate to, that's not judging you, and I hope that voice comes across in the poem. That poem is rambly as it is deliberately, took a lot of craft and construction. That's always the trick to get that voice. Takes a lot of editing, and it seems like it wouldn't be like that to get how do you get the most authentic voice as you go through and you cut and you edit? But there is something about making the art out of that voice that I think is the piece.
All people have to do is sit down and try to do that, and then they'll get that part. it's so hard to do. But why don't you read more poems?
Okay. This poem's called Hurtful. It's true I've never been able to defend myself against your white T-shirt, and that for most of last summer, I confused wanting you with wanting not to be lonely. There are four words in the English language that have no rhymes: orange, month, silver, and purple. I want more than anything to prove that wrong, and the closest I've come is hurtful. So let me clarify. Finally, I do not love you. Who could take a lifetime of your bad poetry? However, there are things I hate you more for: that you can eat French fries and not exercise, that everyone you let be close to you has to need you, strangers gawking because you're radiant, and you are radiant. This poem's called Celebrity Photo, Daniel Craig with Angelina Jolie. The woman he's with has death tattooed on her stomach. The woman he's with makes headlines for cutting her arms, for kissing her brother, for a vial of blood around her neck. She's too lippy, too breasty, too child adoptee for some. And he's looking away. He wants to say, the light on your forehead has nothing to do with God. Or if you were dead, you'd green glow like a morgue. Or what would it be like to kiss your brother? He doesn't want to be in front of the marquee, ignored by her side. He thinks, I'll never be a big star. Will I ever be a big star? It's before the no-neck muscles, the double-stuffed Speedo, before the paparazzi outside his door. The necklace he's wearing is cheap, red, green, purple plastic. He looks like a country singer. He could sing those songs about boots and booty, his honky-tonk baby, God bless America, don't let the unborn babies die. After all these years, you know they were wrong about the sadness of men who love men. It's Palm Springs and you've slipped away from a day of swimming and drinking to lie for a minute with your eyes closed in the other room while the air conditioner moan groans outside the window, your body chilled from sunburn and untouched for months. Startled from near sleep, you hear a crash of laughter, man laughter, the slapping of bare backs, hands smacking the skin of men drying by the pool or making hamburgers in the kitchen or solving a puzzle on the glass table in twilight. Does anybody need another drink and laughter? The pizza's here. Can I have a cigarette? Pass the pretzels and your name. Has anyone seen Aaron? You don't say anything, but listen to the man saying your name. Soon someone will be sent to look for you, and you'll pretend to be sleeping. Say you must have dozed off. You'll rejoin the party soon, but need another minute. You want to remember this. You've waited your whole life for them to miss you. Psalm, Boston. I spilled out of the club at dawn. The ones I'd come with paired off and gone. I walked up Berkeley toward Beacon, toward the river, home. The restaurant on my left where I worked, green awning, revolving door. At that almost hour, details don't matter. The Hancock Tower, an illusion of space, mirrored and bragging to the sky. I would leave the city in a month, still jittery from cigarettes, from pills that promised escape. I fell inside my body, the last place I wanted to be.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Aaron Smith. He's reading from his new book, Appetite, published by the University of Pittsburgh Press. In a lot of your poems, Aaron, you address, refer to, write about popular culture, as in movies, movie stars.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it seems like there's intersections in some of those poems with the popular culture or the culture of people, of the working class,
mm-hmm.
come in, and often religion. And I wonder if you could just say a few words about how it is that you have found a way to have a juncture of popular culture sometimes and religion. If you think that's accurate.
Yeah, I mean, first I'm interested. I always think I want to write an essay. I think popular culture is a working class aesthetic. I think I probably could prove it if I sat down to do it. I think there is something about growing up in a working class family where we watched a lot of television, we watched a lot of movies, and I think that became very much a part of my mythology, of my reference. High and low culture all mixes for me. I look across and I can, you know, see Shakespeare, and I can see it and feel it as deeply as I feel Moonstruck. Maybe I feel the movie Moonstruck even more deeply, you know, and I think that's probably what I was raised with. Also religion, I mean, the sacred and the profane also fall on that scale for me. If it's even a scale, they just sort of fall on that plane where I think they're all able to be brought in and they're all up for grabs. And I think, and I feel as I say it, they all mean sort of the same thing to me. I have a sort of dedication to them where they come from. And I don't mean like, you know, I'm religious, but I mean the same place where that religious reference might come from, the popular culture reference also speaks to me. I don't, you know, sometimes I am poking fun at things, but I think there's always a sort of sincerity that I'm interested in. I think you can only write about Daniel Craig in a way that's meaningful to me is if I really am sort of smitten with the idea of Daniel Craig as a speaker and as a writer. And I think trying to find that particular place of voice is the challenge for me in writing about pop culture. And sometimes I think it is a working class thing. There's sort of this adoration, this longing for that life, even though you know you're not going to become like a famous celebrity. There's something about that being your first experience of the world outside,
mm-hmm.
is the popular culture. I also think it was probably male celebrities, I know this for a fact, were my first expression of desire.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very real and honest to me. And religion, as confusing as it was also first and primal for me too. So I guess I'm going back to childhood.
Mm-hmm. But I think you do some really wonderful intersections of those two, which are so unexpected again. I can't, you know, I don't have one in mind when I'm saying that, but I feel like it's all through your work.
I appreciate that. And class issues are really important for me. I don't think we talk about it enough. And one poem that I can't read on the air because it has some language in it that I couldn't read, I talk about that the speaker talks about the father coming home from the plant. And it was very important for me to know that the father was working at a plant.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the references, I think, for me are working class. And I think it's important that the voice be heard and not be heard in caricature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Be heard
right.
in a way that feels honest and
full-bodied. And,
exactly.
Okay, could you read some more?
Sure. What I wanted, age 8. I wanted Adam Nelson to coach our intramural basketball team with his shirt off. He was Kevin's older brother, and I was full body tingle when he'd say my name, tug my shorts, grunt, good play. I wanted eighth grade boys to wear mesh shirts and tank tops to throw big red balls into shiny, wet arms. I wanted boys to hold my hand like they did the girls. I wanted them to tie me up and make me kiss them. I wanted to cuddle with Magnum P.I., put my chin on his hairy chest and blow. I wanted Eric Estrada on Chips to strip, to shoot someone, then flash his armpits. I wanted the men my dad hung out with to walk around naked when we camped. I wanted all men and nothing but towels, to watch them drop those towels in locker rooms, old locker rooms. I wanted Tommy Shaw to do push-ups and show me his muscles. I wanted Ron Taylor to do push-ups and show me his muscles. I wanted Todd McCafferty to sit on my lap and show me his muscles. I wanted someone to show me his muscles. I wanted to play husband and wife. He'd be the husband and I'd be the wife. I wanted boys to protect me on the playground. I wanted boys to chase me on the playground, to shove their fingers in my mouth, push me down. Casino Royale 2006, The Blue Speedo and Daniel Craig. One oiled up stud, one Lycra lick, blue cling with an inside view, the place something veiny and strange is crammed into. Make him think you could pull a gun. Make him think you're crazy. Make him think you could pull a gun. He'll remember you this way. Men respond to grand gestures. Men respond in their deepest parts to fear. Tell him you've met before. You're sure of it. You never forget a face twisted in pleasure, panic. Watch his mouth dissolve. Watch it betray him. Show him a knife slicing a body, more surprise than pain. He'll pretend he's comfortable, that you really don't scare him, but it's all an anxious lie. You've seen the movies, and every scene is your scene. The psycho singing love songs to the man he loves. Blood, a perfect sunset on the dead mother's cheek. You can taste that light. Tell him nobody belongs to him more than you. Let him think he has some room. Let him think he can choose.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Aaron Smith, reading from his new book, Appetite. Can you talk a little bit about the immediacy of voice in your work, even in what seemed to me to be persona poems, like the last poem you read? There's a sense of proximity that is really powerful in your work, and I feel it with all your poems. It's just, we're right there, we're inside something, mm-hmm. something's going to happen, and that energy is so palpable. Is that something that you work on in revision to bring forward, or is that a goal of yours when you're writing?
Yeah, absolutely. I love poetry because it does feel like the intimate art to me. You know, there is something about looking on the page and seeing the stanzas. I think of the lyric I, you know, of saying something with emotion and intimacy. And I do start writing from a very personal place. And then I think revision is where the narrator really develops. But I'm very interested in, I just really think you have to believe it when you're writing it. I try to pick things that I'm connected to and that I'm attached to. And whether it is sort of comedically attached to Daniel Craig and the Blue Speedo, you know, or I'm thinking back to the eighth grade confused kid and his lust, I really want that to come across as clear and honest and as specific as I can make it. And I think that is the voice that emerges. But I think underneath this is a driving sincerity. Like, I'm not trying to make fun of it. I'm not trying to distance myself from it. I think I'm trying to re-inhabit. And I know the word sincerity gets tricky in poetry circles. So what I mean is, I think what I mean is you have to believe it. You have to really show.
You have to believe it, or the reader?
Me as a writer, you, in my okay. own process. That, yeah, okay. I should say the you becomes I in that statement. I mean, I have to believe it. It's something that has to matter to me. And, you know, I had a friend joke with me. I was walking to the store and I have to have a Stevie Nicks CD today. You know, my friend's like, you don't have one pretentious bone in your body. Because I guess, like, you know, and I'm talking about how Landslide moved me and I watched this great interview with her and, like, mm-hmm. all that stuff is real to me, and I intellectually can understand how it can be hokey or silly, but in my creative self, I give myself permission to really go there and to inhabit that space, and I believe it. And that's how I think I'm able to construct and then revise and further build
that voice. So you commit. You're all in.
Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah, I commit. I hope you commit. Everybody commit.
Okay, I'm with you. Can you read a couple more poems?
Sure. West Side Highway Meditation. This evening, New York looks how it always looks in photos, except more flawed, like someone picked it up and didn't put it back the way they found it. This far west, the buildings could slip into the Hudson, and who would miss them, miss me? This far west, it's all construction, someone's good idea. Each high-rise becomes another high-rise stacked against the soon-to-be black sky. Twilight's only bearable in the city, lights making something different than daylight, little lies saying you're not really alone. This is the life we asked for, and it's everything we expected. There's nowhere else so light and dark at the same time. Because there's nowhere to go when we die, our lives really can be summed up by so many buildings between two rivers. And because they're unfinished, the sky behind glows pink and gray inside them. Psalm, West Virginia. These days when it's raining and I wish it were over, the winter, the year, the students' random commas like shaved away hair, I think now is the time before it all goes bad. A lump not found, a spot on the skin, a dizziness deep inside the brain. Cars pass like little trains, but less ambitious. And I wonder if I'll wish for this. Pillow of gray sky smothering me, the mist on my glasses making it hard to see. No real tragedies to make me unhappy. I'm told I'm depressed, but I think I'm crazy with loneliness from too many bad decisions. Today I say, hurry up, go faster. I don't care what happens. I'm willing to regret it all. Train him. The man across from me on the blue plastic seat is the color of Brandon's new boots and lovely, reading Che Guevara. I want him also to be a revolutionary, to rail against government, end poverty, to eat peanut butter sandwiches in bed. Look at me. Fire Island, June 2008. I wanted Stephen to go on, so I said, go on, and he did. And I stood on the sand, on a strip of land, water and night sky in front of me, water and night sky behind, the stars strung like bulbs too small to be useful. I was moving away next month, trying to slow everything down. Behind black sky, there is more black sky. I said, remember this, so I'd remember. You're still going to die one day, and I will.
The poetry of Aaron Smith, reading from his new book, Appetite. Thank you so much. Great interview.
Thanks for having me.
Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody. 90.5 FM.